From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a journey through the North, Greenland, Iceland, and the Faroe Islands, Lawrence Millman tells us about his voyage of discovery following the route the Vikings took to the New World. Also today, Leonard Corin describes some good ideas that work well in Japan. Rock historian Ed Ward pinpoints the exact moment of birth of country music, and book critic John Leonard reviews Henry Petrosky's new history of The Pencil. Make a note of that. It's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Senate appears ready to override President Bush's veto of a bill protecting visiting Chinese students. The first showdown of the newly convened 1990 Congress will come tomorrow in the House, where Republicans already concede they would not muster more than a handful of votes to support Bush's position. The administration has concentrated its lobbying efforts on the Senate, hoping to get 34 votes there, needed to stave off a two-thirds majority vote to override. But Minority Whip Alan Simpson says the president won't get 5 votes. Police in South Africa erected a wall of razor wire in the main street in Cape Town today to stop a demonstration by high school students. NPR's John Madison reports.
About 5,000 black and mixed-race students tried to stage a protest march from the city cathedral to the office of the Government Department of Education. The students were protesting against the segregated education system under which the government spends more money on each white student's education than on educating black students. But the marchers had not applied for permission to protest, and police officers said the protest was illegal. Police fired tear gas at the crowds and erected a razor wire wall in the street to divide the protesters. The students responded by running through the streets, breaking windows of storefronts in the center of town and at the railway station. I'm John Madison reporting.
South Africa's justice minister said today that black leader Nelson Mandela may be asked to mediate between the government and the outlawed African National Congress after his release from prison. In a newspaper interview, Justice Minister Kobi Kotsetsi said the question is no longer whether Mandela would be freed, but when and under what circumstances. Haitian military ruler General Prosper Avril has continued his crackdown on civilian opposition in the country, with more arrests and severe censorship on the news media. Alan Tomlinson has more from Port-au-Prince.
As reports circulated of more arrests of his political opponents, President Avril issued a new decree, tightening still further the state of siege he declared on Saturday. The Haitian media, particularly Creole language radio stations from which most Haitians get their information, have been ordered to submit all news reports to a government censor. Live broadcasts from news correspondents in the provinces have been forbidden, and there is a total ban on news about Haiti from overseas. Meanwhile, those outspokenly critical opposition leaders and human rights activists who have not already been arrested, beaten up, or deported during the crackdown have fled into hiding and are being hunted by the security forces. The families of a number of fugitives say they have been visited by police and soldiers. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Haiti.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 15 points to close at 2615.32, but declines led advances 4-3. On volume of 179 million shares, the average price of a share gained 8 cents. This is NPR News. A federal judge today ordered John Poindexter to produce a list of specific questions he intends to ask former President Ronald Reagan at Poindexter's Iran-Contra trial. U.S. District Court Judge Harold Green said Poindexter's request for Reagan's testimony is too broad, encompassing a wide range of subjects, including the American use of foreign airfields and meetings between Reagan and the Tower Commission. Two former employees of Cincinnati Bell Telephone Company have been found guilty of defaming the company. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
Former Bell employees Robert Drays and Leonard Gates claim they conducted hundreds of illegal wiretaps in the 1970s and 1980s for Cincinnati Bell. The company called them liars and sued for defamation of character. The jury agreed and awarded the company and two of its managers more than $100,000 in compensatory damages. Judge Fred Cardellano can add punitive damages. He also says he may turn the case over for possible perjury charges.
In my mind, there's been deliberate lying repeatedly throughout this trial. And whether perjury can be proven, that's another matter, because it's very difficult to prove in Ohio.
A federal grand jury last year found there was no evidence of lawbreaking within the five-year statute of limitations. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd introduced legislation today that would ban senators' acceptance of speaking fees. The honoraria ban would take effect next year and include no pay raise to compensate for the loss of income. Some 2,000 ethnic Albanian students demonstrated today in Yugoslavia's Kosovo region to demand free elections and an end to the partial state of emergency in the southern province. At least 28 people died last year in Kosovo during Albanian riots against the constitutional changes which returned the area to the control of Serbia. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation this week. I'm Sedge Thompson. The cold, desolate lands of the North hold a special attraction for my guest, Lawrence Millman, who heads there whenever he can. He's visited Greenland 8 times, Iceland 7, and Labrador 5. During his latest journey, he planned his itinerary by following a course first charted by the Vikings from Norway to Newfoundland 10 centuries ago. Millman's new book, Last Places, tells of his wanderings through the North, marooned with a village of skeletons in Greenland, swimming in a sulfuric, greenish, volcanic mud in the midst of a blizzard, battling giant seabirds in the Shetland Islands. This is Lawrence Millman's 7th book. He's also written about his travels to Ireland in Our Like Will Not Be There Again, and his forthcoming book is an account of his travels to the Ecuadorian Amazon. I ask Lawrence Millman why he chose the route he took across the North Atlantic.
I've long been a devotee of the North, and as my friends seem always to go to the lands of the carcinogenic sun to the south, I always seem to head up north where there's less sun and where I find myself, extremely happy. And I had traveled to most places in the North, and I decided I would go on a prolonged journey in which I would try to link them together, find some way in which cultures rubbed off of each other. And it seemed to me that the best way to do this was to follow the Viking sea route from the Old World to the New World. And I set sail in a passenger ferry called the Nirona from Bergen, Norway, and went to the Shetlands, the Faroes, Iceland, Greenland, Labrador, Newfoundland, and ended up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, some of those places are not obviously Viking sites. I felt that, as with any itinerary, that I could break out of it and go my own way. I mean, one of the purposes of an itinerary is to, in fact, destroy it, rather than to pursue something very, very rigidly.
How fluent are you in the languages of Iceland and Greenland?
Well, in Iceland, you see, I learned Icelandic. I spent a year teaching at the University of Iceland in Reykjavik, and I learned enough Icelandic to get by. But Icelanders are so multitudinously fluent themselves that they could have communicated with me in English or Danish or in many cases French, and in certain cases various Eastern European languages, since a lot of Icelanders in the 50s and 60s went to school in Budapest and Prague and so on. So I wouldn't have needed to have learned much Icelandic. I found that the language more or less a challenge, which is why I set out to learn it. In Greenland, it's a bit different. There are not many people who speak English, and I found that in order to survive, really, I had to learn some Greenlandic. And what I learned, really, at the very outset were words that had to do with food. Usually it's words that pertain to food that come to me first, in that I arrive in a place and, not surprisingly, get quite hungry. So I learned what the word for whale is, and they bring me a whale.
What is the word for whale? Could you give us some examples of some
Sildepiskur. Actually, that's my favorite kind of whale. I'm talking about the food rather than, let's say, the marine mammal. It's jerked whale meat in the Greenlandic fashion, which is a little like beef jerky. It's been hung up to dry. The winds buffet it. The rains assault it. Blizzards overpower it. And after a while, it has this wonderful quality. I mean, it's not just a meat. It's a combination of meat and the weather, and perhaps it gives a kind of resonance of the Northlands as well. I wish I had some right now, in fact. Another food I especially like is hákarl, which is fermented Icelandic shark's meat. That's buried in the ground for, in a gravel pit for up to about 6 months and then hung up to dry, again buffeted by all the elements. And it has a kind of gnarled, desiccated quality. In fact, I got a big piece of it when I was hitchhiking in Iceland some years ago. The piece was sticking out of my rucksack. I was picked up by this Englishman. Now, of course, the hákarl does have a bit of a smell. And I was picked up by this Englishman who kept looking over at me oddly and looking at the rucksack that was in the back seat of his car. And he finally looked at me and said, "My God, man, have you robbed a graveyard?" Given the nature of the way the piece of shark's meat looked and smelled, I could easily appreciate his question.
My guest is travel writer Lawrence Millman. His new book, Last Places, tells of his trip to retrace an ancient Viking route from Norway to Newfoundland. You devote a couple of pages at the end of your book to acknowledgments, including the Guggenheim Foundation for support in writing the book, but also to transport agencies and to different kinds of suppliers. And it reads almost like credits for a traditional exploration, an expedition. And I'm wondering if you had different benefactors for this trip.
Well, I find that to do the sort of thing I do with the kind of impecunious lifestyle I seem to lead, I do need freebies. And I have made a point over the years where friends of mine might go out and make friends with fellow writers. I tend to make friends with public relations people, bush pilots, and their ilk, because I know that at some point they'll be of use in my own wanderings.
One of the people you thank is somebody who included you in a Greenland cruise, and you say all you could offer in return for the passengers was an evening of scatological folktales. And it seems kind of a nice trade. You get help with a journey, and you tell some travel stories that kind of...
Well, these were actually folk tales. I mean, once upon a time, I traveled in Greenland and the Arctic collecting Inuit myths and folk tales, which later appeared in a book called A Kayak Full of Ghosts. And I'll tell you actually how that all began. I had flown from Iceland to the east coast of Greenland with a friend who was a bush pilot who was visiting a girlfriend of his in the small East Greenland village of Kulisuk. And on one of the occasions when he was visiting her, I was walking around the village taking photographs of sled dogs and some of the shacks and a couple of kids eating Eskimo pies, and that's what they're called, and they really like Eskimo pies in Greenland. And I backed up to get a panoramic picture of the village, and I toppled down an icy incline into a Maassluk fjord through the ice. This was November, and it was a startling experience, to say the least. I blacked out, and the next thing I knew, two local fellows had covered me in a blanket and were taking me to the Kulisuk Infirmary. And meanwhile, I was laid up there for a few days, and I found that in the next bed there was this elderly fellow who was drying out, so to speak, in a different way than I was drying out. He had probably had, during the course of a weekend, maybe 72 to 100 bottles of Carlsberg Lager, and was now much the worse for wear. We got to chatting in a mixture of several languages. I was communicating a little bit in Icelandic, which is enough like Danish that he could understand me, and I knew a bit of Greenlandic at that time, and he started telling me these incredible folk tales, including one about a relation of his who, during the winters of 1883-84, when winters were stuck together in the Greenlandic phrase, as he put it, like, quote, copulating dogs, this woman, this relation named Kaligasak, had eaten three generations of her own family, waiting until they were dead, of course. And he told story after story, and I had been familiar with Inuit stories before. These were real different. I realized that the stories that had appeared in most anthologies were cleaned up a bit. They were cleaned up for the benefit of polite Anglo kids, whereas the real thing was infinitely more earthy, more scatological, as you might say, than what I had read. And I made a vow to myself that I would wander the Arctic and collect as many of these stories as I need to collect to get an anthology together. And that's what I did. And as for this trip that you mentioned, I was brought along as a kind of ombudsman between the passengers and the people on shore. And I got the free trip. And what I did was one of the evenings I regaled the passengers with some of the stories that I had collected in, primarily in East Greenland.
And so you yourself have become kind of a Greenlandic storyteller.
Well, I sort of have. I mean, obviously these stories are dying out like most folk tales. And I think one reason they're dying out is not what you might think. I mean, not that you know, the storytellers are dying out. They're really not. It's that the young people seem less interested. I mean, what you find in Greenland, for example, is that all the young people are learning about computer technology. They're studying computers in schools, and they may have even computers at home, even though they don't have any running water. And I mean, I find that too great an admiration for computers tends to be very damaging to the memory. One consigns one's own memory over to what's called a kwasiosut, a little artificial brain in Greenland. Then when you get a story told, for the life of you, you can't remember it. That's what I found in Greenland. I mean, the old people who were sort of pre-computer age knew the stories and they would tell them, but it was the shortened form of memory that the young people had which prevented them from really realizing the stories, appreciating them, and finally remembering them.
My guest is writer Lawrence Millman. He's written several books about his travels. His latest journey took him from Norway through the Shetland Islands to Iceland, Greenland, Labrador, and Newfoundland. His new book is Last Places, A Journey in the North. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Speaking with travel writer Lawrence Millman. I was struck by the amount of alcohol that's consumed in the countries of Greenland and Iceland. You describe people, carrying around cases of beer with them, just as a way we might drink a cup of coffee. I wonder what effect you saw on the people of Greenland and Iceland from all this alcohol.
The effect, it's really different. I think in Greenland. From Iceland. I mean, Iceland is a white, essentially European culture where people, owing to runaway inflation, have to hold down two or three full-time jobs. And drinking tends more or less to be a weekend activity. And they really get knackered. But somehow, miraculously, they're ready for work on Monday morning. In Greenland and Labrador, it's a little bit different. You have people deprived of their traditions for one reason or another, the last link with those traditions being their right to hunt, which various organizations like Greenpeace are trying to deprive them of. And they've got a lot of time on their hands. They've also been deprived of their ancient religion. And I've often had the theory that one reason they drink so much is that they are trying to get back in touch with the ecstatic, you know, the kind of rarefied realm they had before white man came, in which all things were holy and all things natural, which in which gods lived inside rocks and trees and even lemming droppings on the trail, where everything was just sort of energized and animate. I think one of the most perverse examples of it occurs in Labrador, where the Innu, who are a native group in Labrador, a group of Indians, the young kids tend to have what's called dynamite parties. And they'll get drunk, and then one fellow, a little bit more brave than the others, will bury himself in the ground, and there'll be a stick of dynamite placed in the ground not too far from him, let's say 5 or 10 feet away. And it will be ignited, and it'll go off, and it'll explode, and out he'll come flying from the ground and be catapulted, quite a distance. If he lives, well, he'll be catapulted if he lives and if he doesn't. But there have been many instances of kids blowing themselves to smithereens of doing this. It's sort of like, you kind of think that it has something to do with traditions lost. I mean, after all, in the old days, they did tend to get elevated, as it were, by natural phenomenon. Now they don't. And so they are forced to elevate themselves artificially.
This also seems to be a way of destroying their culture simultaneously.
Yeah, well, and their lives too, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. My guest is writer Lawrence Millman. I was interested to read your references to what it was you were reading when you were in the midst of the barren, glacier-swept landscape. You'd be in your tent, it'd be perhaps snowing outside or very cold, and you'd be reading a Georges Simenon mystery, set obviously in arrondissement in Paris. And it seemed like this wonderful discontinuity, you seeking out the rural isolation while reading an urban mystery novel.
Well, I must say that Simenon novels are very good for backcountry trekkers because they're very small and you can stick them into... You know, you can stick them between the sweat socks and the thermal underwear, or you can find some little niche in your rucksack that hasn't yet been filled, and you can bend the book back and shove it in. It's much easier to carry around, 5 or 6 Simenons than maybe one Tolstoy.
That's an interesting way of choosing your literature for the field.
Right. I happen to like Simenon very much, too. When you asked me that question earlier about what I brought along, and I mentioned all the essentially foul weather gear, I neglected to mention what I think of as yet another example of foul weather gear, which are books. I mean, invariably, one tends to be stranded, tent-bound, rained upon, and removed from normal human communication during the course of one's wanderings in the North. And one of the best companions you can have in such circumstances is a book. And I found invariably, there was one time when I was stuck in East Greenland with a hunter, and it was raining, sleeting. I mean, every type of possible foulness from the sky was coming down on us. And fortunately, I had among my provisions about 6 or 7 books of different types, including Suetonius. And I was reading there in the remote fjordlands of East Greenland, The Lives of the 12 Caesars. I was quite delighted, to say the least.
You keep as pets some giant Madagascar hissing cockroaches?
Yes.
Living?
Oh, they're living. Yes, they're living and very, very active.
Where did you collect them, in Madagascar?
No, I got them from Harvard, as a matter of fact. A friend of mine is a professor of insect studies there, and he had his freshman class dissect a bunch of these. I saved them from the surgical knife, and I have now about 8. Giant Madagascar hissing cockroaches and 5 giant Suriname non-hissing cockroaches. And they're wonderful creatures. They're really very, very beautiful. They have this quality of having survived intact from the Carboniferous period without any changes, as indeed they have. But another reason I have them, I spend a lot of time traveling, a lot of time away from home. And if I had any other kind of pet, I would have to kennel, billet, or find some place for that pet to be removed while I was away. But the nice thing about these cockroaches is they're just as happy not to have me around as they are to have me around. They can survive quite a long period of time, I'm told upwards of a year, without water or food. I mean, obviously, by the end of that time, they'll be a little bit emaciated, but they'll still be alive.
Do these cockroaches make an audible hissing sound?
Well, they make an audible hissing noise. And in fact, I mean, they do it on several occasions, I've discovered. They tend to do it when they're about ready to mate. They tend to do it when you pick them up and they don't want to be picked up. But I've also found that atonal music played on the radio causes them to hiss. And, you know, you may think that's a joke, but it's absolutely true. I mean, any kind of loud, rasping noise usually causes them to hiss. And what I've concluded, it's not so much that they tend to be irritated by it, but they're listening to something by Schoenberg, for example, and they think Schoenberg is a fellow giant Madagascar hissing cockroach. And they hiss in response.
You were born in Kansas City. Do you feel any connection with the Midland of America, or do you find that you have to travel to these far-flung, exotic, barren places for your satisfactions?
Well, I don't feel much connection, really. I mean, I think that it's always nice for a travel writer to come from a place that he doesn't particularly like and thus have an adversary relationship to that place, because he will always, in his mind, be trying to get away from it and seek out new and even more exotic climes. I mean, I think that that's my case, and I think that in the case of Paul Theroux, he's forever trying to escape from Medford, Massachusetts. I don't know if you've ever been to Medford, but if I were to choose between Medford and, let's say, Kansas City, I probably would choose neither.
You have honored places such as Greenland and Iceland because of their isolation and the fact they seem relatively untouched by outside influences. Do you also fear that a travel book might entice people to visit Iceland and Greenland?
Well, I don't think my book will. I mean, I don't think I've made those places attractive enough to start a tourist stampede. I mean, who wants to go to a place, for example, like the Faroes, where you'll be seeing harbors filled up with whale's blood, or places like Greenland where, try as you might, you're not going to even find the remotest semblance of a cucumber or a carrot. And I think most people would just be happy to stay at home and read about it. I'm not too worried that they're going to be spoiled by travel writing.
Well, thank you very much for coming and being with us on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you, Sedge. Let me leave you with one parting word in Labrador Inuit. Umayalutungetugavit asasak.
Which means?
I hope a sea monster doesn't get you, my friend.
Well, and to you, safe journey.
Thank you.
Lawrence Millman's new book is Last Places, A Journey in the North. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actress Elaine Stritch. I hope you can join us.
When the storm clouds are riding through a winter sky, sail away, sail away. When the love light is fading in your sweetheart's eye, sail away, sail away. When you feel your son is orchestrated wrong, why should you prolong your stay?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Living and working in both America and Japan, Leonard Koren noticed dozens of Japanese things that might be valuable in America, too. Gadgets, traditions, marketing ideas, all sorts of stuff. He's collected those items in his book, 283 Useful Ideas from Japan. Coming up, Leonard Koren tells us what the Japanese have that we don't. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the exact moment the American idea of country music was born. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new history of one very useful but surprisingly complex idea, the pencil. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. No sooner had members of Congress returned to Washington than they prepared to hand the White House a stinging defeat. Members of both parties said that they would vote to override President Bush's veto of a bill that would protect Chinese students in the U.S. from persecution back home. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
The bill would allow Chinese students studying here to apply for permanent resident status when their student visas expire. Currently, they are required to return to China for 2 years before applying for any other visas. The president vetoed the bill, saying it was unnecessary because he could offer the students the same protections by executive order. But Democratic leaders in Congress said the veto sent the message that the White House is on the side of the hardline Chinese leadership instead of the students who protested for democracy in China. The House votes on the veto tomorrow. It is expected to muster the two-thirds vote necessary to override. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The government of East Germany said today that its economy grew only 2% in real terms last year, instead of the 4% which had been expected. The government report said during the fourth quarter, the national income of East Germany dropped 3% from the same period in 1988 because of the exodus of tens of thousands of workers to West Germany. The government of East Germany has begun to dismantle large portions of the Berlin Wall, and has indicated its interest in selling the pieces to museums or wealthy individuals. NPR's Mike Schuster filed this report from Berlin.
Until last night, the East German authorities had opened up new border crossing points through the wall, but the wall remained almost entirely intact. Last night, though, border police began to take down the wall in earnest. Workmen using heavy machinery removed more than 600 feet in slabs 6 feet wide by about 15 feet high. The East Germans have chosen slabs where the colorful graffiti on the western side has not been picked to bits by hundreds of people who have been hammering away on the western side since November. Equal lengths of the wall are expected to be removed each night this week. The authorities are putting up a 6-foot-high wire mesh fence in its place. I'm Mike Schuster in Berlin.
A Polish businessman said today that he plans to open the first private bank in Poland since World War II. 20 state-owned factories and cooperatives own a bank that operates independently of the state financing system, but Poland has no private banks. A fire has heavily damaged the second floor of the world headquarters of the Aluminum Company of America in Pittsburgh. Officials say the blaze caused an estimated $400,000 in damages. No one was injured. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 15 points to close at 2,615.32 on volume of 179 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. By the late 1920s, phonographs and radio broadcasts carried new kinds of music to all but the most rural reaches of our country. Local folk musicians were influenced by these new sounds, and in turn, folk elements showed up in newly written, copyrighted songs. So-called hillbilly records were selling in the South, and jazz aficionados here and abroad bought up sounds of the country blues. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has learned that the first inklings of the meld we now call country music could be heard early in the decade.
In June 1922, two men wearing Confederate uniforms appeared at the Victor Company in New York. Brandishing a couple of fiddle cases, they demanded to be recorded, and to humor them, the folks at Victor agreed. That afternoon, Henry C. Gilliland and Eck Robertson became America's first country music stars. But even though their record of Arkansas Traveler and Sally Gooden sold far better than anybody'd expected, Victor wasn't convinced they should try any more of this stuff. Instead, it was a young man named Ralph Peer, working for the OK Record Company in Chicago, who set off the boom by discovering and recording Fiddlin' John Carson in Atlanta in 1923. Carson's record sold very well indeed, and soon both Columbia and Victor were offering mountain music, as they called it. Victor had the first million seller in 1925 with Vernon Dalhart, a Dallas-bred New Yorker who'd sung opera, and suddenly the company got very interested. Ralph Peer went to work for Victor shortly thereafter. If the country music industry could be said to have a birthday, it would be the 2 weeks between July 21st and August 5th, 1927. Ralph Peer, armed with the latest electrical recording equipment, set up at 408 State Street in Bristol on the Tennessee-Virginia state line.
Have you been to Jesus for the cleansing power? Are you like in the blood of the Lamb? Are you fully trusting in His grace this hour? Are you like in the blood of the Lamb? Are you like in the blood, in the soul cleansing blood of the Lamb? Are you garments spotless as they white as snow? Are you like in the blood of the Lamb?
Ernest Stoneman was a local musician Peer had worked with before, and he'd helped Peer book the first week's worth of sessions. He also helped Peer with the second week by letting a local journalist observe the recording sessions and write in the subsequent story that Stoneman was making $100 a day, his musicians $25 a day, and that in the past year, Stoneman's recordings had netted him $3,600. That did the trick. Out of the hills they came, toting fiddles, harmonicas, guitars, and banjos. Peer loved what he called holy roller music and was delighted to discover Ernest Phipps.
I want to go, Lord, I want to go. I want to go where Jesus is. I want to go where Jesus is. Lord, I want to go where Jesus is.
He also realized that such stuff had limited commercial potential and was very happy when, on August 1st, Mr. and Mrs. Carter from Mesa Springs, Virginia, showed up. Peer had mentioned to Carter that he'd like to record him, but somehow nothing had happened. Now, not only had A.P. Carter and his wife Sarah shown up, but they'd brought along Sarah's 18-year-old guitar-playing sister, Maybelle. Peer loved the interplay the family got with their voices and instruments, but he was particularly taken with Sarah's voice and arranged for her to do a solo session the next day. Maybelle's distinctive outlining of the melody on the bass strings of her guitar became the Carter family's signature. But there was trouble with another group Peer had been depending on. The Tenava Ramblers were immensely popular in the area, especially now that they'd added a young singer from Mississippi on banjo. Now that they were going to record, though, he wanted special credit on the record label, and the other guys weren't going for it. The night before the session, they threw him out of the band, recruited another banjo player, and taught him the next day's songs.
The longest train that I ever saw was on that Georgia line. The engine passed at 6 o'clock and the cab it passed at 9.
At 2 o'clock, the fired banjoist showed up with a small guitar and asked to audition for Peer. Peer wasn't too sure. Most of what the guy had been doing was contemporary pop material, but he had a gimmick that might work.
Hey, baby, sleep.
Rogers only cut two sides that day, and only one had his trademark yodeling on it. But as it turned out, that was all rural America needed to hear to start demanding more. Pure recorded many other musicians during those weeks in Bristol, but it was the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers who went on to establish what eventually wound up being called country music as a viable commercial entity. The songs they recorded were written, copyrightable, not folk music. And while more traditional recordings continued to sell, the Carters and Rogers gave a glimpse of the future. If you'd like to hear more of the Bristol sessions, you can get the fascinating record I used for this piece from the Country Music Foundation at 4 Music Square East, Nashville, Tennessee, 37203.
I'm glad Ed Ward has his curiosity. That address again is the Country Music Foundation, 4 Music Square East, Nashville, Tennessee, 37203. Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. The recycling truck pulls onto your street. Your newspapers and magazines are picked up and exchange. You get rolls of toilet paper. Toilet paper! Not a bad idea. That's the way it's done in Japan, according to Leonard Corin, author of 283 Useful Ideas from Japan. He's written a book aimed at Western entrepreneurs or just those curious to see how things are done in consumer-oriented Japan. His book is laid out in the style of a graphic comic book with captions and descriptions. These drawings are by a Tokyo-based illustrator. Corin and his Japanese wife live part-time in Tokyo and part-time in San Francisco. Corin divides his book into four sections: products, services, marketing, and communications. One provocative idea from the service section is the capsule hotel. These hotels consist of stacked Pullman-style sleeping compartments equipped with a television, radio, alarm clock, and a small shelf. I ask Corin how the more compact than cozy capsule hotels reflect a certain way of life.
Well, the way of life has caused very little space, and what there is, very little physical space, and what there is very expensive. So actually, if you're inebriated and it's late at night, the trains have stopped running, and it's going to cost you $50 to take a cab home, you might as well spend $30 and sleep in a little capsule hotel not so far from your office. It has all the amenities you need. It looks strange to Westerners because it reminds us of a coffin, but of course Japanese, they burn people when they die, so they don't have the same associations. Think of it more as a large bathtub with a bed and a lid.
Have you stayed overnight in one of these capsule hotels?
No, but I keep threatening my wife that I will when we get into arguments.
You've worked as an architect and a designer, and I'm wondering how you run this sort of trans-Pacific life between Tokyo and San Francisco. Do you have an architectural practice in both cities?
No. Actually, I was trained as an architect, but most of my professional life has been spent in the publishing world. First, I was publisher of a cult underground magazine called Wet, the magazine of gourmet bathing. And I work as a magazine consultant and a book packager, mainly for Japanese magazines, and a book packager mainly here in the United States. And books are rather portable objects. You could do them any place you are. So it doesn't really make any difference where we are.
What kind of ideas are you able to bring to the Japanese as a magazine consultant? Do you have a similar set of useful ideas from this country that you're able to take there?
Well, culturally, everything that happens in the United States ultimately becomes manifest in Japan, too, anywhere from 3 to 5 to 7 years later. So I could see trends for magazines that are needed, let's say, like in the medical sphere, patient empowerment, magazines that help people take care of their own health, in Japan, it's kind of taboo to ask a doctor in too detail about your body condition. You're supposed to submit to him. It's a kind of master-patient relationship. And in this country, it's more like going to a mechanic. You spend a lot of money to go to the doctor if you have the money, but you expect to get straight answers. So I could see certain social trends here that will eventually end up there and plan magazines or magazine columns around that.
One thing that struck me when I've seen people talk about Japan and design in Japan is how objects are revered there in a different way than in the United States.
Well, objects as a medium of communication has a much... as a medium of communication between people, has a much deeper and longer history in Japan than it does in any of the Western cultures I know of. We've all heard of the Japanese tea ceremony, which is basically a ritual about objects and how the objects are used to communicate different messages of a social nature between people. And really, that's really the paradigm for all Japanese relationships to objects. Here, you know, we think, oh, well, the design of an object, the style, the fashion says something about a person. But there, I think objects make much more definitive statements of who you are. Plus, there are fewer options in Japan for self-expression than there are here because of the space, because of the cost. So objects and shopping for objects takes up a lot more psychic space, energy, and time than it does here. Whereas here, having 26 varieties of answering machines doesn't seem very significant. For some reason, in Japan, it does. With such little space, the attention to detail becomes very great, and the distance, both physical and mental, between ideas as represented in objects, seems a lot larger than it does here.
You were a founder of the co-founder of the Los Angeles Fine Arts Squad that went around doing large outdoor murals. Are you frustrated by not being able to do similar large outdoor murals when you live in Tokyo, or have you sort of accommodated your way of life to one that's more compact and attentive of space?
Well, I painted large-scale murals when I was in my early 20s, and I was living in Los Angeles, which is a sprawling outdoor city geared to the automobile, and it was a response to that environment. In Tokyo, survival and thriving in that environment, actually, it's helpful if I go inside and deal with things that are of a more personal I guess, introverted interest to me. And as I get older, the joy of anonymity and the joy of privacy becomes more apparent. I'm not interested in shouting things out to society at large anymore. I'm not interested in shouting. The kind of, let's say, artistic or creative voice that I feel now is more refined and more subtle and not at all as loud as it was when I was in my 20s and 30s.
I want to get back to a couple of the ideas that are in your book. One of the food ideas in your book is that of sort of hiring a tree, taking ownership of a tree for a season, and you're entitled to all the produce that comes from that tree for the year. Is this something that you yourself do in Tokyo?
It's something we've talked about doing. Because my mother-in-law in Osaka keeps sending us food all the time to our apartment in Tokyo, we don't really have a need to do that. But we've talked about buying trees that'll eventually be made into lumber as a kind of a social investment. combining sort of a kind of a ecological awareness with a good return on our money.
How will that work?
Well, let's see. How does that work? You basically buy a tree in the Japanese version of Siberia, and it might take 20 years to mature, and at the end of 20 years, they chop down the tree, and they make it into lumber, so they don't have to import lumber from Oregon, and you get the money that the lumber is sold for, and it's something like a 10 or 15% per year return on your investment when figured out over the long run.
Could you also then use the lumber if you needed it?
Or is it? That's not part of that deal, but it's like money products. They're all variations of it. I'm sure there's one like that. The buying an apple tree that yields a certain crop a year, and either taking physical possession of the fruit yourself, going there and picking them yourself, having them having the farmer box it for you and ship it to you, or just getting a certain percent return on your money after the farmer markets the fruit. Those are all schemes that exist.
Well, Leonard Korn, I want to thank you very much for coming in and being with us on Fresh Air today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Leonard Korn is the author of 283 Useful Ideas from Japan, published by Chronicle Books of San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. Later today here on National Public Radio is today's edition of All Things Considered, and as usual, full and comprehensive, co-host Linda Wertheimer has stopped by to give us a preview. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Sedge. We're leading our show today with the Congress, which returns to Washington. This is the second year of the Bush administration. Presumably the honeymoon is over and all kinds of issues are before the House and Senate. The former president, Ronald Reagan, has some problems as well. There was a hearing in court today about whether the former president could possibly be called to testify in the trial of one of his aides, John Poindexter. We'll also be paying a lot of attention, as we have been for weeks, on the crumbling empire of the Soviet Union.
Thank you very much, Linda. All that and other stories later here on National Public Radio. As long as you keep it sharpened and have strength in your hand to drag it across paper, a pencil will serve you well. There's a new book that contemplates the pencil and its glories by Henry Petrosky, a professor of civil engineering at Duke University. The book's called Pencil, A History of Design and Circumstance. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Finally, a book that tells us, how does the lead get into the pencil? Though Henry Petrosky takes a long time getting to his point, and by the time he arrives, we already know that it's not lead anyway. It's a compound of graphite and other stuff. The American pencil consists, in fact, of graphites from Sri Lanka and Mexico, Mississippi clay and Oriental gum, in a case of California incense cedar with an eraser made out of South American rubber and Italian pumice stone. To achieve this pencil, you must know as much as Petrosky does about dyestuffs, shellacs and other resins, solvents, pigments, lacquers, inks and glues, drying, abrading, impregnating and extruding. From previous books by Petrosky, such as To Engineer is Human, we've learned to expect these delightful detours, not only through the chemical and mechanical arts, but in philosophy and politics as well. My only complaint about the pencil is that he complains too much that nobody's written about it before. If they had, he might not have. About engineering, Petrosky wants us to realize that unlike the pure science of the Newtonian sort, it begins with purpose, to which it adds research and development, after which there's marketing. Newton liked to walk on the beach. The implication, says Petrosky, is that the truths are whole in the ocean, and it's just a matter of time before they are found thrown up upon the shore. But abstract theories do not make pencils. Engineers do. If the so-called lead pencil only appeared in the middle of the 16th century, after millennia of unacceptable 18th dynasty Egyptian pig stickers, the Roman animal hair penicillium, the Chaucerian stylus with wax tablet, the reed pen, the bird quill, and the silver point, It was because of the discovery of a big load of graphite in Cumberland, England, in the Lake District, where all those poets came from. English hoarding led to the French Revolution and the Conte crayon. It also led to the fearful Fabers, those Teutonic pencil barons whose monarchism, obsessive secrecy, cruelty to factory workers, and sibling rivalry and fratricide opened the door to democratic American innovation and price-cutting. Which is where we meet Henry David Thoreau, who manufactured pencils as well as books. Nor is Thoreau Petrosky's only trafficking in highbrow culture. In his pages we'll also meet Cicero, D.H. Lawrence, Jane Austen, Toulouse-Lautrec, and Claude Lévi-Strauss, plus, of course, all those engineers who basically think with their pencils, after which they make artifacts, practical things like bridges and light bulbs and steam engines and bombs, even in Russia, which is rich in Siberian graphite, although not so much in China, where the lead falls out. Along this long way, reference is made to Diderot, Escher, and Edison. Fun is made of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and we are made to think about the pencil as humble servant, engineering miracle, and complicated metaphor. I found myself staring at the very yellow thing I used to mark the many pages of this marvelous book. I also remembered a witty remark Petrosky should have included. Asked why she'd missed her deadline at the New Yorker, a notoriously stingy magazine, Dorothy Parker explained, "Somebody was using the pencil."
John Leonard scribbles about television for New York Magazine as a columnist for New York Newsday and as media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Pencil by Henry Petrosky. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Elaine Stritch talks about her work and song with Woody Allen, Noel Coward, and Stephen Sondheim. And novelist Ann Beattie, known for her keenly observed details of life, tells us how the notes on her icebox serve as a kind of diary. That and more next time on Fresh Air.